In the heart of Bakersfield, California, a legend was born. His name was Merle Haggard. From a troubled youth to one of the most influential voices in country music, Merle Haggard's life was a journey of triumph over adversity. Memories and drinks don't. As the poet of the common man, Haggard's music resonated with audiences across America, capturing the struggles and triumphs of everyday life. Looking at the world through the bottom of a glass, his impact extended beyond music. He became a voice for the working class, a symbol of resilience, and an advocate for prison reform. Through his raw, heartfelt lyrics and timeless melodies, Merle Haggard's legacy continues to inspire generations, reminding us that from hardship can come great beauty. Join us as we explore the life and legacy of the one and only Merle Haggard. But here I am again. Merle Haggard's early life was marked by hardship, resilience, and the formative experiences that would ultimately shape his music and worldview. Born on April 6, 1937, in Sildale, California, Haggard's childhood was deeply influenced by the Great Depression and the challenges faced by his family during that tumultuous period in American history. Haggard's parents, James and Flossie Haggard, were originally from Oklahoma and had relocated to California in search of better opportunities. However, their hopes were dashed by the economic hardships of the era, and they struggled to provide for their growing family. The Haggard household, which eventually included Merle and his siblings, faced financial instability and the harsh realities of poverty. Tragedy struck the Haggard family when Merle was just 9 years old. His father, James, passed away unexpectedly, leaving Flossie to care for the children on her own. The loss of his father had a profound impact on young Merle and would influence his music and worldview for years to come. The absence of his father and the economic struggles faced by his family led Haggard down a troubled path during his adolescence. He began to rebel against authority, became involved in delinquent behavior, which ultimately led to a string of minor criminal activities. At the age of 14, Haggard's rebellious acts landed him in a juvenile detention center, marking a turning point in his life. It was during his time in the juvenile detention center that Haggard discovered his love for music. Inspired by a performance by country music icon Lefty Frizzell, he found solace and purpose in music, teaching himself to play the guitar and immersing himself in the sounds of country, folk, and the blues. This pivotal moment would set the stage for his future as a musician and a songwriter. Haggard's experiences instilled in him a deep empathy for the struggles of the working class and a profound understanding of the hardships faced by those on the margins of society. These formative experiences would become central themes in his music, shaping his identity as an artist known for his raw, emotive storytelling, unapologetic approach to songwriting. Merle Haggard's early life was marked by hardship, loss, and a transformative encounter with music. It laid the foundation for his remarkable career as a pioneering figure in country music. His ability to channel his experiences into deeply resonant music underscored the power of art to transcend adversity and speak to the human experience.
Merle Haggard, we're glad you're here, buddy.
Well, thank you, Wally.
Worldwide, I mean, this guy is known everywhere all over the world. His songs are played on the Capitol Records. See, we do have Bonnie Owen and the Strangers. That's the Merle Haggard Show. Greetings, everybody, friends and neighbors. Keep them cards and letters coming. Hey, listen, Fugitive, Branded, Swinging Doors, take your choice. Whatever you want to do, I just named three of my favorites there, Merle.
How about Branded Man for a start?
All right. Okay. Let's give him a big hand. How about it, everybody?
I'd like to hold my head up and be proud of who I am, but they won't let my secret go untold. I paid the debt I owed them, but they're still not satisfied. Now I'm a branded man out in the cold. When they let me out of prison, I held my head up high, determined I would rise above the shame. But no matter where I travel, the black mark follows me, and I'm branded with a number on my name. I'd like to hold my head up and be proud of who I am, but they won't let my secret go untold. I paid the debt I owed them, but they're still not satisfied. Now I'm a branded man out in the cold. If I live to be 100, I guess I'll never clear my name, 'cause everybody knows I've been in jail. No matter where I'm living, I got to tell them where I've been. They'll send me back to prison if I fail. I'd like to hold my head up and be proud of who I am, but they won't let my secret go untold. I paid the debt I owed them, but they're still not satisfied. Now I'm a branded man out in the cold. Now I'm a branded man out in the cold.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Haggard's musical journey started in the 1950s. He became one of the leading figures of the Bakersfield sound, a reaction against the slick production of Nashville music. The Bakersfield sound is a genre of country music that emerged in the 1950s and 60s, primarily associated with the city of Bakersfield, California. It was a reaction against the polished, orchestrated sound coming out of Nashville at the time. The Bakersfield sound is characterized by a raw, stripped-down style, often featuring prominent electric guitar, pedal steel guitar, and a driving rhythm. This sound was popularized by artists such as Merle Haggard, Buck Owens, and Wynn Stewart. This subgenre of country music is known for its honky-tonk influence, with a focus on relatable lyrics and a more rebellious, rough-edged sound compared to the smoother, more polished Nashville sound. The Bakersfield sound had a significant impact on the development of country music and continues to influence artists to this day.
Bakersfield, California, was the original capital of alternative country. Migrants from the Texas and Oklahoma dust bowls in the 30s depression had kept their music alive there. The Bakersfield sound shot to prominence in the 50s with the music of Buck Owens.
I couldn't stand all the silky, syrupy stuff that was coming out of Nashville. You know, everything is so sweet. Oh, don't play too loud, dear Harry. My God, somebody might think you got some personality. You know, it was awful to me. But here, you immediately had these edgy musicians, my musicians. They played on the edge of speeding, edge of making a beat go faster, but not faster, but up there, where it made you want to shut up and dance, baby.
Down the street we call Sam's Place. Yeah, and it starts to jump at every evening when the sun goes down. You can always find me down at Sam's Place, 'cause that's where the gang all hangs around. That's the
Jimmy Shakespeare. She hails Pasadena. She always got a big smile.
I think Nashville felt that Bakersfield was a bad smell that they wished would go away. You know, it really had nothing to do with the scene in Nashville, but country radio loved that music, so they had, you know, there was a certain coexistence that had to go on.
Country radio has always dominated country music. It's often the only way for the music to be heard. Buck made sure his songs burst out of car radio speakers.
AM radio was all we had, but the bass, you know what a VU meter is? It's what they have when they record. And when the guy hits the bass and it takes up 40% of the VU meter, means you got 60% left for everything else. So I said, you know, get that bass out. I don't want to. And many times they're just rumbling around all over the record, you know. And so that's really what happened. If you listen to my records, you'd say, boy, he hated bass, didn't he? Well, I didn't really hate bass. I liked bass, but I liked the bass in accordance with everything else. My music had a little pizzazz to it, as my good friend Harlan Howard would say. I remember the day we wrote Tiger with a Tail. I was riding down the road. He was touring with me down in Texas. And he pitched the lyric up in the front seat and said, here, now put the hydromatic to it. It's called hydromatic. And what he meant was the freight train sound, the on top of the beat. I've got a tiger by the tail, fancy. Yeah, won't be much when you get through with me. I'm a losing weight and turning mighty pale. Oh, it's like I've got a tiger by the tail.
I've got a tiger by the tail.
Some people play back of the beat, real laid back. Others play kind of medium, and we get right in the middle. I played up on top of whatever the top was. I just felt it like that.
Looks like I've got a tiger by the tail.
That sound was called the Bakersfield sound because of those musicians living and working there in nightclubs. But ironically, the sound that was the Bakersfield sound was recorded, for the most part, in Hollywood, at the beautiful Stacker Records building over on Vine Street, the Capitol Records Tower.
It was here that the unique talent of record producer Ken Nelson was instrumental in Buck Owens' success.
What made Buck a great performer was that he loved the public, number one. and he felt that he was giving them something. And he would get out there and just wow the audience.
When Buck and most guys went in to record those songs, the music had a very immediate connection to those honky-tonks and dance halls, because they were playing them the following Thursday and Friday and Saturday nights again. And they were writing some of those songs on the way to and from those shows.
They're gonna put me in the movies. They're gonna make a big star out of me.
We would get to the studio, and he knew what sound he wanted. He knew what kind of arrangement he wanted. He was the whole, he was Buck Owens.
To his knowledge, of all the records I ever made for him, he never heard one of them before I recorded it. He never knew if I was going to bring three trombones and a Salvation Army drum.
Ken Nelson's hands-off approach was the very opposite of the Nashville system, and it gave Bakersfield freedom to create its unique style. It had many followers.
The Beatles were fans of Buck, and they would—they asked me to send them dubs of everything that Buck recorded. If I recorded a session with Buck, I would send it to the Beatles. And let me see, they recorded one of his songs, Act Naturally, I believe. But they were fans of Buck.
They were Little Richard, Chuck Berry things, and Buck Owens things. You know, and I thought, man, what nice company that is.
2, 3, 4. All I gotta do is act naturally.
The music scene in Bakersfield essentially grew out of the western migration of the Okies from Oklahoma, primarily in the Midwest, after the Dust Bowl. They were country people, and they took their music with them.
The Dust Bowl past of the Okies was given voice by another great Bakersfield artist, Merle Haggard.
It's a big job just getting by with 9 kids and a wife. Yeah, but I've been a working man, dang near all my life, and I'll keep on working.
I think Merle Haggard was the next Hank Williams, because he was the most articulate songwriter, the voice of that generation. You know, Bob Dylan was the voice of the college student's generation. Merle Haggard was the voice of the working man. You know, how do you survive day to day? He spoke for those people.
Mama's Hungry Eyes was written about a period in America where there were places like labor camps. And there was a lot of people that was in these labor camps that weren't ignorant. And they weren't a lot of things that Steinbeck thought they were. My aunt and Uncle Esker lived in a canvas-covered cabin beside the railroad track in Houston, California. And I got to visit them once in a while and really get to know those people and see the impact that the Depression had on them. And Mama's Hungry Eyes probably tells that story best.
A canvas-covered cabin in a crowded labor camp, stand out in this memory I revive. 'Cause my daddy raised a family there with two hard-working hands, and tried to feed my mama's hungry eyes. He dreamed of something better, and my mama's faith was strong, and us kids were just too young to realize that another class of people put us somewhere just below. One more reason for my mama's hungry eyes. Oh, I still recall my mama's hungry eyes.
When I first started to record Merle, I became so enamored with his singing that I would forget what else was going on. And I suddenly, hey, wait a minute, there's a musician here that you've got to worry about. But his songs, he was a great writer.
Merle Haggard drew inspiration from every aspect of his life.
My dad passed away when I was 9. And I don't know if you've ever thought about somebody you've lost, and you say, I wonder what so-and-so would think about this. And I was driving on Interstate 40, saw a sign that said 19 miles to Muskogee. Muskogee was always referred to in my childhood as back home. So I saw that sign on my whole childhood flashed before my eyes, and I thought, I wonder what Dad would think about the youthful uprising that was occurring at the time, the Janis Joplins, and you know, and I understood him. I got along with it. But I thought, what if he was to come alive at this moment? And I thought, what a way to describe the kind of people in America that are still sitting in the center of the country saying, what is going on these campuses?
We don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee. We don't take our trips on LSD. We don't burn our draft cards down on Main Street. 'Cause we like living right and being free.
The song struck a chord with the diehard traditional audience of the Country Music Association.
We like holding hands.
But somehow it also appealed to younger fans, like the crowd at the Armadillo in Austin.
We don't let our hair grow long and shaggy.
We all sang it. We adopted it. It was kind of funny. You know, it was like we knew Merle better than that.
I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee. Place where even squares can have a fall. We still wave old glory down. In Muskogee,
Oklahoma, USA. I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on the wars we fight. Things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life, our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country halls, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Let this song that I'm singing this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Merle Haggard is often hailed as one of the most influential figures in country music history. He is renowned for his extensive catalog of hit songs, known for his raw, emotive storytelling and authentic voice. Haggard's music has left an indelible mark on the genre, resonating with audiences for decades. One of his most iconic hits is Mama Tried, released in 1968, a soulful and reflective song chronicling the struggles of a wayward son trying to live up to his mother's expectations. The poignant narrative, coupled with Haggard's emotive delivery, made this song an instant classic, capturing the essence of personal redemption and resilience. Another notable hit is the 1969 song, Okie from Muskogee, a song that became an anthem for a particular segment of America during a turbulent time. This patriotic, satirical take on the perceived divide between traditional and counterculture values struck a chord with listeners, propelling the song to the top of the charts and solidifying Haggard's status as a voice for the common people. Also in 1969, Working Man Blues is yet another timeless hit that embodies the blue-collar ethos and resilience of the American workforce. With its upbeat tempo and unapologetic celebration of hard work, the song became a favorite among fans and remains a staple in Haggard's repertoire. Haggard's The Fight Inside of Me, released in 1970, is a fervent, patriotic anthem that resonated deeply with audiences during a time of social and political upheaval. Its unapologetic defense of American values and criticism of dissent struck a chord with many, earning Haggard both acclaim and criticism, but undeniably leaving a lasting impact on the country music landscape. These hits, among many others in Haggard's extensive discography, showcase his ability to capture the essence of everyday life, societal shifts, and personal struggles, establishing him as a true icon in the realm of country music and music in general.
Merle, is it true that you have been nominated more times for more awards than any other male country artist?
Someone told me the night that I was second to Loretta Lynn, I think, for nominations. I think I have more have the most for a male artist, I think.
How's that make you feel?
Good. Nice to know that. I really hadn't counted it. Ralph Emery brought it to my attention a while back. He called me on the phone and said, Chief, you're the king. He said, you've got more nominations than anybody else. And I hadn't noticed that, but it's nice to find out.
Does it make you feel like you've really fulfilled your life, that you've done everything you wanted to do?
Well, I did that before I found out about the nominations. I surpassed all dreams that I've ever had in life. And I've got to set some new goals for myself so I don't get bored every once in a while now. Because I've had a great life, had some great things happen to me.
What were your dreams when you were a young man starting out in the and starting to become successful in the business?
Well, really, I never had my sights set all that high. I intended to be a player, musician. That's what I wanted to do, just make a living playing guitar. And I wasn't good enough, so the singing thing was discovered in the process, and Fuzzy Owens, steel guitar player in Bakersfield, California, kind of put up the money for my first records, and the very first records began to do well and received some recognition right off the bat, and we wound up on a major label with Capitol Records, and after the third release on a small label. And over the years, we've managed to sell several million records, and the career has been one that hasn't just... It wasn't just a flash in the pan. It lasted, and I guess we've been somewhat in the same position for about 15, 18 years now.
This is pretty... this is quite a fancy... fancy schmancy outfit you've got here. You're driving around. We're inside your bus. I don't know if they can see it on camera. Maybe if we're lucky, you can take us through.
We'll try to take you through.
And show us a little bit of the bus. You came... we're in Nashville now, but you started off really further west, around Bakersfield, right?
That's where I was born and raised, and I grew up listening to the Grand Ole Opry, like a lot of people in America did. I think it came on at 7:30 every Saturday evening in our part of the country, and I recall Red Foley and Roy Cuff and George Hay and all those people, and Hank Williams, but a lot of my influence came from the Midwestern type country Western music. Bob Wilt and his Texas Playboys, that type of music was very big in California when I was a child, and so I have kind of a loose mixture of influences that make up the type of music I play nowadays.
And you have made, 52 albums somewhere in there?
I think so.
52, 54, have you lost track?
I really don't know. I think it's right around 50.
It could be one or two either way there. I'm not sure. And some religious albums, too.
Yeah,
I did a couple of gospel albums over the years. One being one that was just released called Hymns for the Mama That Tried, which came from the song titled Mama Tried, and it's done for my mother. My mother's 79 years old. She's still in good health and everything. Of course, she's a Christian lady, and she's always after me to do these type of songs, so we did an album for her. It just came out. You travel quite a bit, and your wife, Leona, is an entertainer in her own right. Leona Williams also appears with you on stage.
She comes out and does her own show, and usually the procedure is that we take an intermission, and she comes back out with me and assists me on guitar. She's also a fine guitar player. So.
I'm sure most people know that she's your wife. Do you introduce her as your wife as part of the act?
No, I don't. I try to leave the personal wife off the bandstand. I try not to do things that bored me as someone in the audience. Over the years, I've seen that happen so many times, you know. And it just wasn't interesting to me. So we keep it professional on stage, and then when we go back to the house, well, we play house, you know.
Play house, yes, of course. Leo, let me ask you a question. You travel a lot together. You work together, and then you go home together. Is that hard, being together a lot like that?
We were discussing that one way, didn't we?
Yeah. Well, Merle goes fishing quite often.
That's right. You just had his first annual bass tournament, right?
Right.
Lake Shasta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this year, matter of fact. And it's going to be a yearly thing. And he goes fishing. And we're not together all the time, but I enjoy being with Merle. I'm kind of a togetherness family type person, and I enjoy it. You know?
Well, you need a little break. How often do you travel? How often are you on the road?
Well, it depends. At certain times of the year, we're out for long periods of time. We're sometimes out for 3 months. We don't go home for 3 months.
Do you always travel on the bus?
No, we sometimes have to go to the air, but the bus becomes our home out here. We have all of our clothes and all of our personal belongings are here, and our bed.
Do you live on the bus when you're...
Yeah, we actually live on the bus.
You cook on the bus?
Sometimes.
Who does the cooking?
Both of us.
Oh. Both of you cook?
Yeah. Yeah.
You cook for them?
Yeah, I cook beans and taters, stuff like that.
You're the fine cook.
Is he good? Is he a good cook?
He really is.
Well, what's his favorite meal that he cooks?
He fixes really good pinto beans and...
I like chili beans. Mm-hmm. I fix chili and...
Country food we fix, mainly.
Black-eyed peas, stuff like that.
What's your favorite things that she cooks for you that you like?
Same thing.
both like the same food, right?
He likes his food more spicy than I do, so I don't quite, put as much that type of thing in my food.
She doesn't put as many jalapeno peppers in her beans as I do mine, but basically the same.
A little more spice in there. You got another bus. You got the band travels on another bus, right?
Yeah.
How many miles would you say you travel a year?
About? Well, we just got through with a bus that we'd had with us since 1970. Okay, we made its last trip about a week ago, and I would venture to say that there is well over 2 million miles on that vehicle, so you can break that down into a couple 100,000 miles a year.
Speaking of breaking down, what do you think, what if you're on the
100,000, what is it? I can't figure that out, I'm too tired.
What if you're on the road and you break down, and you're East Chicken someplace and you've got to be somewhere?
Well, it happened just the other day. We have to go. We have to rent whatever we can rent, truck, whatever, go on.
What's an outfit like this cost? It's got everything in it. It's a beautiful one.
Well, the shell, I understand, has just gone up like everything else. The shell empty costs $129,000. That's without tires, without any inside at all.
Which you must have. You should have tires on the bus.
Should have tires. this particular coach was built in Columbus, Ohio, and it cost $289,000. And I didn't like it either, the cost.
You got to amortize that out over a few years.
When I started buying buses in 1970, you could buy this type of bus for $80,000. You know, that was what they went for at that time.
How many have you bought?
I think this is our fifth coach. We had one coach, the band coach we've had all through the years. I've changed coaches about every 3 years, the same reason you change cars, for economical reasons, so you don't get caught with an old coach.
What did you two meet?
Right here in Nashville.
Here in Nashville. Now, you've been married, what, about 3 years?
I was married 3 years on October 7. We've been together going on 7 years, so we've known each other that long.
Been slipping around about 7 years.
How did you meet?
All through records, hearing each other's records, and then we all came to Nashville. And, there was one of the guys in his group that I knew, Ronnie Reno, called me, and he was recording that night and asked me to come down to the studio. And I came down and meet a guy that has the golden throat of our country music business.
Did you know who you were coming to meet?
Oh, yeah. Well, I talked to him on the phone before I left the house, and he said, can you be here in 30 minutes? And I said, well, I got to fix my hair first. it was 1975, when I met him. And so anyway, I went down to the studio and met him.
And then how long after that? How long a courtship did you have before you?
Well, I was in the process of terminating another situation, so was she. So
that's an interesting. That's a terminating another situation.
Mine was terminating.
TAS, terminating another situation. You had another situation that was already terminated.
Right.
Yes, all right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we got with it pretty quick. Well, we all left. You know, I dodged her as long as I could, you know, and finally she just.
Well, our story actually goes back to like 1969. I was recording for a label called Hickory Records, and I had a song called When I Stopped Dreaming. And anyway, Merle heard the song in California, and he had his secretary to call Nashville to find out about Leona Williams. Well, anyway, we never did meet at that time, and whatever. We never did get to talk, even, did we?
No, my secretary saw your picture. She never would give it to me.
Oh, how rude. Why was that?
Ah, pretty lady.
Secretary.
She saw problems in the air.
Yes. Yes, it's the old secretary trick.
Yeah.
Remember that.
And anyway, later on in the years, I would hear people say, do you know Merle Haggard's a big fan of yours? Really made me feel good, you know. I said, well, I'm sure a big fan of you, too, you know. So anyway, one day we met.
Well, look at this little guy down there. I just noticed. There's a third member of our party here.
This is
there
Tuffy.
It is. Hi, Tuffy. Sorry, we didn't mean to wake you, Tuffy.
Say hi, Tuffy.
She's actually
here. Golly, let me get back down.
Okay, back to sleep, Tuffy. Now, you're recording now on Elektra Records.
That's right.
And Merle, I understand this is some significance to this week in Nashville for you, too, because you're starting a new relationship with CBS Records.
That's true. We've actually been with CBS now for about 90 days, and this is the first big function that we've all been able to get together at the same time and meet each other, and I'll have to say that I'm very impressed with CBS. They are head and shoulders above anything I've ever experienced before. They're really good company.
What do you like to sing about?
Life. All aspects of life. Good and bad. Happy and sad. Running. Staying. Crying, dying, going away, you know. All that type of thing. I love to write about things also. I like train songs. And, I've written songs about planes. I guess there's as many things to write about song-wise as there is on the face of the earth, you know. It could be about a flower, it could be about somebody picking a flower, you know. There's no end to it. It's really a rewarding business, or at least for me it is. I feel like I've given birth to a child, you know, when I have a piece of good luck, write a good song. Well, people all know what my favorite song is. Well, I really don't have any. It's just probably the last one I wrote, you know. If it was good, well, I'd be like asking a mother to single out a child, you know. But I'm really proud of my songs. And I've tried to write about a lot of different things.
And now you've just written your first book, Sing Me Back Home. It's your autobiography.
Right.
What prompted you to write it?
Well, actually, I've been writing it in songs for years. And Leona felt it should be done. I'm sure the success of some of the other people in the Venice Loretta Lynn's book and what autobiographies have always been a successful thing because they're real. And
much work and never enough play. And I'm tired of these dirty old sidewalks. Think I'll walk off my steady job today. Turn me loose, set me free. Somewhere in the middle of Montana. And give me all I've got coming to me. And keep your retirement and your so-called Social Security. Big city, turn me loose and set me free. Haven't got a thing to show for anything I've done. There's folks who never worked and they've got plenty. Think it's time some guys like us had some fun. Turn me loose, set me free. Somewhere in the middle of Montana. Give me all I've got coming to me. And keep your retirement and your so-called Social Security. Big city, turn me loose and set me free. Big city, turn me loose and set me free.
Sitting on that, sitting on the drum riser. Jerry Lewis was rehearsing, and we were going through, you know, Good Golly, Miss Molly, and Jerry's pumping the shit. And I turned round to my right, and there's this other cat sitting next to me. And he's wearing, one of those straw Stetsons and a grizzled beard. And he looks at me and he gives me a grin, and I hear him a grin. And I get two more bars through the song, and suddenly I realize it's mine. You know, and I almost lost it then. You know, I'm sitting next to one of the greats. And turn back. He turns around and gives me a nod and a wink, and we carry on. I managed to get through the song. But he playing bad shit, you know what I mean? Picking, you know. I recall last Sunday morning a choir. I mean, to meet, you know, one of your favorites, one of your heroes, maybe, yeah. Guy you always admired, and you meet him sitting on the next side of the drum riser.
There's a song, yeah, my mama
that is
sang.
The shit, yeah.
Could I hear it once before you move along?
Haggard's music often reflected his experiences resonating with working-class Americans. He became known as the poet of the common man for his honest and relatable songwriting. Merle Haggard's influence on country music and beyond is immeasurable. As an artist, songwriter, and performer, his impact has shaped the genre and inspired countless musicians across multiple generations. Haggard's authentic storytelling, emotive delivery, and rebellious spirit have left an indelible mark on the music industry, influencing artists from various backgrounds. His impact on country music is profound. Haggard's music is often characterized by its raw honesty and working-class themes. They resonated with audiences in a way that transcended traditional country music boundaries. His influence on the Bakersfield sound, a reaction against the sleek, orchestrated Nashville sound, redefined the genre, paving the way for a new wave of country artists seeking a more authentic, stripped-down approach. This led to the progressive country movement in country music that eventually then led to what has been called the outlaw country music movement. Beyond the confines of country music, Haggard's influence has touched artists across genres. His ability to capture the essence of human experience and societal themes made his music universally relatable. Musicians from rock, folk, and Americana have cited Haggard as a significant influence on their work, acknowledging his impact on their own songwriting, storytelling, and performance styles. The list of artists influenced by Haggard is extensive and diverse. From the outlaw country movement, spearheaded by artists like Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings, to contemporary musicians such as Keith Urban, Miranda Lambert, and Eric Church, Haggard's impact is evident in their music and approach to the craft. His influence also extends to rock musicians, including the Rolling Stones, who covered a Haggard song, Honky Tonk Nighttime Man. Haggard's legacy as a musical trailblazer and cultural icon continues to reverberate through the works of artists who have been inspired by his uncompromising spirit and authentic storytelling, as well as his unapologetic approach to music. His influence remains palpable in the fabric of American music, ensuring that his legacy endures for generations to come.
I'd been up about 5 days, and we'd been doing a cayenne pepper drink, and we went on a fast.
10 days.
I'd been up for 5 days and nights working on this album, and the fifth day, I went to sleep in my bus about 5 a.m, bam, bam, bam on the door, and it was Willie. And I went out there, and he said, I think I found us a song. And he had it written on a paper bag. It was torn open. And it was about this long, and there was more words than I'd ever seen in my life. He said, the band's about got it. He said, let's go in and cut it. So we did it, and I went out, well, back to bed. Woke up the next morning, came in where the records were being made, and I said, can I put my voice on that Poncho and Lefty? And they said, hell, it's on the way to New York. And I had no idea what I'd done. I didn't know whether I was in key, if it made sense or anything, you know.
On a better ride it sailed, could have had him anyway. I only let him slip away.
But he'd found the song in an Emmylou Harris album, was what you told me that night.
I was in the studio, I think, here in Austin, and needed another song, and I heard it written by an Austin songwriter.
Yeah,
Towns Van Zandt.
Towns Van Zandt.
Great song.
Throughout his career, Haggard received numerous accolades, including multiple Grammy Awards and induction into the Country Music Hall of Fame. Merle Haggard, a towering figure in country music, received numerous awards and honors throughout his illustrious career. His contributions to the genre and his impact on music as a whole were recognized by prestigious institutions and organizations, solidifying his status as a legendary artist. Haggard was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 1994, an honor that underscored his significant influence on the genre. In 2010, he was also inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame, a testament to his exceptional skill as a songwriter and storyteller. Throughout his career, Merle received multiple Grammy Awards, including Best Country Vocal Performance and Best Country Song. His album, Same Train, Different Time, won the Grammy Award for Best Album Notes in 1971, further showcasing his impact as a musician and a performer. The Academy of Country Music honored Haggard with the ACM Awards for various categories, including Top Male Vocalist, Album of the Year, and Single Record of the Year. These accolades underscored his enduring popularity and the critical acclaim his music received both from the industry and from fans. Haggard's impact on the music industry was also recognized by the Kennedy Center Honors, one of the United States' most prestigious awards for lifetime achievement in the arts. This honor highlighted his cultural significance and contributions to American music. In addition to these major accolades, Haggard received a multitude of other awards and honors from various organizations, including the Country Music Association and the American Music Awards, further cementing his legacy as a pioneering artist in the realm of country music. Merle Haggard's remarkable career and his enduring influence on music have been celebrated through these awards and honors, reflecting the profound impact he had on the genre and the lasting legacy that he left behind.
And the winner is Merle Haggard.
Top Male Vocalist of the Year is Merle Haggard.
And the winner is?
The winner is, Are the Good Times Really Over?
For him, time is silver. He's been voted now top new male vocalist, top male vocalist 6 times, and Entertainer of the Year.
Here celebrating his silver anniversary with his latest number one hit is The Hag.
Mighty Merle Haggard!
Country music's been great to me all my life, and it's great again tonight. Thank everybody for the participation in one of my most eventful evenings. Good evening. Thank you.
The 18th Annual American Music Awards.
Thank you. Yes, I am a friend of tonight's honoree, so I know a lot of things about him, things that make him deserving of this special award. He's been a superstar for 30 years, and he's released a total of 574 songs and 67 albums. He's been on the music charts since 1963. He's had at least one top 10 single each year for 24 years, and 38 of them have gone to number one. Well, Hag, it's the 90s now, and you've come a long way, and you're still going strong. And I know when you talk about the start of your career, you always mention how you admired and enjoyed playing the music of the greats like Bob Wills, Ernest Tubb, and Lefty Frizzell. Well, Merle, these days, you're the one who's influencing so many other performers. Merle, let me show you I can read. Let me read the inscription on this award. Because his voice is among the most recognizable in country music, because his songs have brought us his deepest feelings and experiences, and because for 30 years he has initiated, revitalized, and continued to bring the best of traditional country music to the world, the American Music Award of Merit is presented to Merle Haggard, January 28, 1991. Here you go, bud.
Sometimes it's tough being a country boy, especially in the city, but you made me feel wonderful tonight. Thank you very much.
I wish a buck was still to sell, and it was back when the country was strong. Back before Elvis, before the Vietnam War came along. Before the Beatles and yesterday, when a man could still work and still work. The best of the free life behind us now. The good time's really over for good. I wish Coke was still cola and the joint was a bad place to be. And it was back before Nixon lied to us all on TV. Matter of fact, before microwave ovens, when a girl could still cook and chop wood. The best of the free life behind us now. The good time's really over for me. Boy, they're over it. I've been rolling down the hill like a snowball headed for hell. With no kind of chance for the flag or the liberty bell. I wish a Ford and a Chevy still last 10 years like they should. The best of the free life behind us now. The good time's really over for good.
Over the course of his life, people tried to define Merle Haggard's sound in many different ways, from classic country to the Bakersfield sound to outlaw country. But whatever niche you try to put Haggard in, odds are that he would break out of it eventually. After all, he spent his whole life escaping from the boxes people put him in, often literally. Haggard's youth sounds like something out of a country song, which makes sense considering many of his hits were inspired by the realities of his hardscrabble life. His family moved to California during the Great Depression and lived in a converted boxcar. When Haggard was a child, his father died and he began acting out. By 13, he was serving his first stint in a juvenile detention center, but it was far from his last. In and out of detention facilities, he ran away from home, hopping a freight train and traveling the country before returning to California, only to face more jail time. He kept getting arrested and kept escaping from prison one after the other. In 1957, though, he pushed his luck too far. Now 18, he was sentenced to a real prison for adult offenders, San Quentin Prison, a maximum security penal institution not far from San Francisco. And with his reputation as an escape artist, they weren't taking any chances with Haggard.
With my reputation of escape, they wouldn't let me out of the cell after 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Because you'd escaped so many times previously.
Yeah.
And he was determined to escape from San Quentin as well. But a meeting with a death row inmate helped scare him straight, especially after Haggard's cellmate, whom he had planned to escape with, busted out of the prison only to be dragged back in irons for execution after shooting a cop during the jailbreak. Suddenly, escaping didn't seem like such a good idea. But there was another escape available to Haggard. Music. After 18 months in San Quentin, he was finally allowed some measure of freedom inside the jail and began playing music with other inmates. Then came an incident that changed his life. In 1959, Johnny Cash visited San Quentin for his first prison concert. Though his 1969 visit would become one of his most famous performances, that first prison concert at San Quentin was just as legendary, for in the crowd was Haggard, who was inspired by Cash to take up country music as a career and life vocation. Haggard said in his autobiography, he had the right attitude. He chewed gum, looked arrogant, and flipped the bird to the guards. He did everything the prisoners wanted to do. He was a mean mother from the South who was there because he loved us. When he walked away, everyone in that place had become a Johnny Cash fan. Haggard, who had learned to play guitar as a youth after his brother gave him a 6-string as a gift, soon joined the prison's country music band and started to hone his songwriting and performance skills. In 1960, Haggard was paroled after serving 2 years of his sentence. He quickly got a record deal and his career took off. Haggard was one of the pioneers of what they called the Bakersfield sound, a version of country music that was more honky-tonk and rock-inspired than the slick, overproduced music coming out of Nashville at the time. The country legend went on to score 38 number one hits on the Billboard country charts, many of which crossed over into the mainstream. And in the 1970s, his insistence on working outside of the Nashville establishment made him an important voice in the outlaw country movement. And as for his prison record, after many years of keeping it a secret, Haggard eventually revealed it to the world in 1969 on the Johnny Cash Show, supported by his idol. 3 years later, the then governor of California, Ronald Reagan, gave Haggard a full unconditional pardon.
Haggard's music often reflected his personal beliefs, including patriotism and pride in the American working class. He also became an advocate for prison reform, drawing from his own experiences with the law. Merle Haggard was known for his advocacy on various social and political issues, often using his music as a platform to express his views and raise awareness. Throughout his career, he addressed topics such as prison reform, the plight of the working class, and veterans' rights, using his influence to shed light on important societal issues. One of Haggard's most notable advocacy efforts was his involvement in prison reform. Having served time in San Quentin Prison in the early years of his life, Haggard had a first-hand understanding of the challenges faced by inmates and the shortcomings of the criminal justice system. His experiences inspired him to advocate prison reform, and he used his music to bring attention to the struggles of those behind bars. Songs like Sing Me Back Home and Mama Tried were influenced by his time in prison, offering a poignant portrayal of life behind bars and the impact of incarceration on individuals and their families. In addition to his advocacy for prison reform, Haggard also addressed social and political issues in his music. Okie from Muskogee, a song that initially garnered attention for its patriotic and conservative themes, became a symbol of cultural and political commentary during a time of social upheaval in the United States. While the song was embraced by some as an anthem of traditional American values, it also sparked debate and reflection on evolving cultural landscapes that showcased Haggard's ability to provoke thought and discussion through his music. Haggard's advocacy extended to supporting veterans in addressing the challenges they faced upon returning home. He was vocal about the need to support veterans and their families, often using his platform to raise awareness of the struggles and honor their service. Through his music and public statements, Merle Haggard demonstrated a commitment to addressing societal issues and advocating for change. His ability to use his influence as a musician to shine a light on important causes solidified his legacy as not only a remarkable artist, but also as a passionate advocate for societal and political change.
Nice hand from my good friend, Merle Haggard. Thank you, John.
With your kisses. I've got a great Merle Haggard story that I felt was appropriate to tell here. I had an encounter with Merle when I was 15 years old in 1991. I went to Branson, Missouri on summer vacation with my grandparents. And we went to this theater there called the Willie Nelson Theater. And this is where Willie was doing shows when he was going through his stuff with the IRS, trying to make money back, pay him back. And Merle would do shows there from time to time. And I was a punk 15-year-old kid. I didn't like country music at all. The last thing I liked. And I was going to these shows like the Oak Ridge Boys and stuff and wearing my headphones, my Walkman cassette player, while there's a live concert going on in front of me. Yeah, that's what kind of punk kid I was. And but I knew better when we went to the Merle Haggard show because I, you know, I was aware of Merle being a legend from my dad listening to him when I was growing up and stuff. So he played the show, and afterwards you could line up, and they had a meet and greet. You could line up and buy a picture and get Merle to sign it. So I did that. And when it came my turn to meet him in line, I said to him, Mr. Haggard, I just want you to know, I'm not a fan of country music at all. And that was the best concert I've ever seen in my life. And the look on his face, I don't know what he was going through. He must have been going through it at that time. You know, he was 54 years old at that time. Country radio wasn't playing his songs, not his new stuff. I mean, they played his old hits occasionally, but country music wasn't really playing him anymore. I don't know. I don't know, but he was definitely going through something. When I said that, his face, it changed. I get emotional even thinking about this, talking about this, because his face totally changed when I said, he said, son, you have no idea how bad I need to hear that right now. Put it there. He put his hand out, shook his hand, he grabbed my hand. He saw my picture. I walked away. As I was walking away, I heard him go, son. And I turned around and went, yeah, the Merle Haggard's calling me, son. You know, he goes, son. I go, yeah. I turn around and he goes, thank you. Whatever it was, whatever he was going through, when I told him I wasn't a fan of country music, but that was the best show I've ever seen in my life, at that moment, that was what Merle needed to hear. And it did something to him. And I'll never forget it. It was one of the most powerful moments of my life because I could tell that it meant something to Merle. Whatever he was going through that day, meeting me and having me say that to him, that I wasn't a fan of country music, that was the best show I'd ever seen, and it was. It was truly incredible. Hit after hit after hit. It was amazing. It was life-changing. It really was. And I got to be honest, I never put down country music ever again after that day. Never again.
Stayed with me through thick and thin. You watched me lose, you watched me win. Pick me up off of the ground. You never one time let me down. I was drowning in a sea of make-believe, as helpless as a fallen leaf. You gave your hand to me that day, and you did it because you're made that way. And you I can fly.
feeling sure you love me, let me know. Darling, just remember these three words. I love you, I love you, I love you. And you could be your natural high. And I can fly
Even after his passing in 2016, Merle Haggard's music and influence continue to inspire new generations of musicians and fans, solidifying his status as a country music icon. As a cultural icon, Haggard's influence continues to reverberate through the fabric of American music, ensuring that his legacy endures for generations to come.
I hear people talking about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on the wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me.
My own music came from a need to have something to sing. I had to have something to say. I had to have something to sing. I had to have something to identify in something, some way in music to tell people that were listening to me who I was.
If you don't love it, leave it. Let the song I'm singing be warning. You're running down our country horse. You're walking on the fighting side of me.
My problem is I thought I grew up too fast, and I didn't want to go to school. I wanted to go to work. And they wouldn't let me, and I wound up being thrown in jail because I wouldn't go to school, and then I would break out of these little juvenile road camps and run off and wind up stealing cars. And I was 19 years old. I really messed up, but I don't like to talk about it. But anyway, in that process of all of that, somehow or another, music seemed to be the only way out of the whole rut that I had been born into. I had been born into a period of struggling Americans who had just kind of like wiggled their way out of a Great Depression and into a period of some sort of security they found in the valley there, and the music that came forth was as pure as it could be, because it was real.
First thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride. On a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, no one could change my mind but Mama tried. What an only rebel child from a family meek and mild. My mama seemed to know what lay in store. Despite all my Sunday learning, toward the bad I kept on turning till Mama could not hold me anymore. I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. What was to be right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better.
My cousins and aunts and uncles were strung out between Oildale and Wheat Patch, and they were living right in the exact spot where The Grapes of Wrath was filmed. And out in front of these old tents and half canvas-covered cabins and things of that nature, you know, you'd hear a guitar once in a while. My dad and grandpas would have on Saturday night, been if they'd had a little band, they'd have went to somebody's house and played in the living room, you know, and left the doors open, and the kids would be sleeping in the halls, and they played till daylight, you know, and that was a dance in those days. And then they went to schoolhouse, and schoolhouse, they built the whole place out, the old barn dance, you know, with the barn. I think what happened is those places like Lamont, California, Arvin, California, popped up out of the grape vineyards, the places where these migrated people lived. There was beer joints that came up out of there, and those little beer joints had little bands, and the kids, probably the kids of these people that came out, wound up in these little beer joints, like I did. Getting to hear yourself on a microphone for the first time, you know. And back in those days, you know, the most desired thing in the world is just to be able to sing over one of those old Shure 55s, you know, and one of those square jobs, you know. Boy, they sounded good. We tried to play like Chuck Berry. We tried to play like Elvis. We tried to play like Bing Crosby. We tried to play like whoever was that had music on the radio. And there were people like Bill Woods who seemed like he was first. He's the first I remember being down there in those clubs. But the Bakersfield sound, solely on its own, was, I think, probably nationally recognized through Tommy Collins and Gene Shepherd and Wynn Stewart and Ferdinand Husky. There were probably other ones that I'm forgetting, but I think they were the ones that did the best with it. The Maddox Brothers and Rose were certainly taking it to a national level. And they had a little guitar player named Roy Nichols. He was a couple of years older than me then. And I idolized him. He was the first guy I ever idolized as a kid. He was my first hero. He was 16 years old working with Maddox Brothers and Rose, and I was 14 playing guitar, and that's what I wanted to do. So, I mean, Roy Nichols was, why, hell, he didn't even have to go to school. He was playing guitar.
Then sing a little bit of these working man blues. Well, I keep my nose on the grindstone, work hard every day. Might get a little tired on the weekend after I draw my pay, but I go back working. Come Monday morning, I'm right back with the crew. Drink my beer at a tavern and then sing a little bit of these working man blues. Blank, blank.
I think that it was inevitable that I was to be a singer because I never did want to be a singer. And even after I was in music and it had a lot of people let me know they liked my singing, and every time they'd ask me to sing a song, somebody else in the band would I'd say, hey, man, I was hired to play guitar. You sang the song. Was my attitude. And, you know, they finally get me up there to sing, but I really didn't want to sing.
He'd be working time, long as his two hands are fit to you. Drink a little beer in a tavern and then sing a little bit of this working man blues.
We love you.
There's a big brown cloud in the city, and the countryside to sin. The price of life is too high to give up. It's got to come down again. But worldwide war is over and done, and the dream of peace comes true. We'll all be drinking that free bubble up, and even that rainbow stew. When we find out how to burn the water, and the gasoline car is gone. When an airplane flies without any fuel, and the sunlight heats our home. But one of these days when the air clears up, and the sun comes shining through, we'll all be drinking that free bubble up, and eating that rainbow stew. You don't have to get high to get happy. Just think about what's in store. When people start doing what they ought to be doing, then they won't be booing no more. When a president goes through the White House door, does what he says he'll do, we'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. Eating rainbow stew in a silver spoon underneath that sky of blue. We'll all be drinking that free bubble up. Silver spoon.